Morning, Severn. How we doing? So if you're just joining us here at 20 Gambrels Road, this week marks week 9 in our sermon series out of the book of James called Do Something Bold. If you've happened to miss any of the sermons in this series thus far, I'd like to just encourage you, get on your computer, get on your phone, visit our website, www.severn.cc. It's in the bulletin that you were handed at the door. Check us out. All the sermons from that series are up to date, and we're constantly updating content on that page, so we'd love to see your traffic there. So if studying the Bible is something that is novel for you, it's new for you, the book of James is named for its author, James, who happens to be the half-brother of Jesus. So wrap your mind around that one. James is the half-brother of Jesus. He worships his half-brother as God. That's pretty heavy stuff, in my opinion. So in essence, this letter is a letter penned by James, who's a pastor of the church at Jerusalem during the first century. The 5 chapters that he writes contain some of the hardest-hitting, most practical texts that I believe we find in the Bible, if you're looking at it from cover to cover. Throughout his letter, what James is basically stating and reiterating time and time again is, if you are a follower of Jesus, your life should bear witness to that. It should bear witness to Jesus' work for you, Jesus' work in you, and Jesus' work through you. And this is what James is saying time and time again, that the mark on a believer's life should put us in a different category than if we weren't actually following Jesus. James says lots of things throughout this book that really challenge the paradigm of how we think and how we do life. He says things such as, if we've been shown the love, the mercy, and the grace of God, then we should be people who do the same thing. We exhibit love, mercy, and the grace of God. He explains how we should respond to trials. He gives us a real frame of reference as to how we might understand the trials that we experience in our lives. James is a very, very extremely practical book, and I know I've said this before, but I want to say this again. And basically what he's saying is, if you believe the gospel, if you believe the good news that Jesus has done everything that needs to be done, that he's fully accomplished the work that needed to be done, that he's ripped you from death and put you in life, then your life should be characterized by certain qualities. And I'm not talking about awkward qualities. I'm not talking about things that kind of put you on a margin and make you seem weird to your colleagues or your friends or the people in your social network. I'm talking about qualities that have you acting, speaking, and thinking the way that Jesus acted, spoke, and thought when he was walking around on planet Earth. So then, James, if we look at his letter, I'd like to say that it's this. It's an after Jesus text. He's not writing it to a bunch of random people. He's writing it to people who have outwardly expressed that they're following Jesus. These are people that state that they love Jesus. They're making this claim. And so if you are a person who has that same claim, you're making that same claim that you're a follower of Jesus, the book of James is a book, it's aiming right at you. It's aiming right at me. And it's not because James or the Jesus we follow wants to make us feel bad. It's because we're being called to higher ground in this thing that we call Christianity. So as we move through our text today, I'd like for us to just consider the things that James is reminding us with regard to the Christian life. And one of those things that he's going to get into today, it's something that's treasured by the people who have it, and it's sought after by the people who don't. It's something that we need. Without a shadow of a doubt, we need this. But sometimes we're looking it in the eye and we often reject it. It's something that isn't birthed overnight. You can't get online and order it on Amazon.com. It's not traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It's not something that's easily attained. So I'd like to pose a question. And the question is this. You're a person. You've got one wish. What do you wish for? What's it going to be? And so just take like 13 seconds and think about that. What are you going to wish for if you're given one wish? So from where you sit, did you give the Miss America answer? Were you like, I wish that all poverty and hunger would end immediately? Or are you a real person? Were you honest with yourself? Did you wish for stacks of money? An end to the trial that you're smack dab in the middle of? an end to a relationship that's just bringing you down, an end to a circumstance through which you're going, and you can see zero light at the end of the tunnel. So the fortunate part of our lives is that God is not a genie. He's not going to approach you and say, hey, Joe, give me your best shot. What are you going to wish for? However, there was a point in history when God himself did approach a human being, and he said, you got one request that you can make, and I will grant that request. And so this is kind of a pop quiz from something we've heard earlier in this series. Who was that person? And Solomon, right? So Solomon's that guy. God approaches him, and he says, Solomon, make a request. And being capable of asking for absolutely anything under the sun, because the person making that or making that statement is the person who owns all wisdom, who owns all things, namely God, the God that we find out about in the Bible. What does Solomon ask for? What does he ask for? Wisdom, absolutely. He asks for wisdom. And in the 10th chapter of 1 Kings, we hear that the entire earth, as a result of the wisdom that God grants Solomon, seeks out the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God himself had put into the mind of Solomon. So the first point that I believe that James is going to drive home for us as we cruise through chapter 3, verses 13 through 18, is that wisdom is in fact a lifestyle. It's not just a thought. It's not just something that you're gonna read a book about and all of a sudden have. It's something that you're gonna functionally do. And so wisdom is what James is introducing the Jerusalem church to. He's also introducing it to us this morning. And specifically, what he's going to do throughout this text is challenge our paradigm concerning wisdom. He's going to explicitly outline what I'm calling counterfeit wisdom. And he's going to then end by describing authentic wisdom. So as we study this morning, I'd like for you to keep this in your mind. To live well is to live wisely. I'm going to say that again. To live well is to live wisely. And so the first point that I'm going to get at, that I believe James is getting at, is that wisdom is indeed a lifestyle. And here's what James says. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. So in verse 13, it seems as if James is lancing a rhetorical question at his audience. It seems as if he's also delineating what the image of wisdom in the life of a Jesus follower should look like. So the question that James uses, in my opinion, it seems as if James is familiar with his audience, and it seems as if the implications behind the question are that these particular people, they know where wisdom comes from, they're accustomed to praying for wisdom, they seek wisdom, and they've done so to the degree that they even believe that they have it. So they're sitting in their seats, and they're wise. So James, in the opening of his letter, if we rewind all the way back to chapter 1, he says something to his people, and he points to the owner of all wisdom in chapter 1, and he says, he who lacks wisdom, ask God, because God owns all wisdom. And then he informs us that if we ask God for wisdom, God will freely divvy out a healthy dose of wisdom to whoever's willing to ask. So it can be assumed, based on James's knowledge of his audience, that this is not necessarily a rhetorical question. Perhaps what it is James' method of calling these folks to examine their lives, to consider their lives and whether or not their conduct and their actions are evidence to the claim that they have on wisdom. So in a basic sense, James is really, what he's really saying is, oh, you're wise? That's nice. Give me some evidence. Prove it. And we see that because the way in which the author James uses the word to show is he's literally asking for hardcore concrete evidence that these people are wise. And so he's not summoning these particular individuals to calculate and to go back in time and to look through the corridor of time and find those three times when they were nice to somebody or the two times when they exercised good, sound moral judgment. He's not talking about isolated events in the lives of his people when they hit the mark of following Jesus. Instead, what he's saying is, are our daily lives marked by conduct that demonstrates that we actually know what we're talking about, that we actually possess wisdom? And that's what I believe he's getting at. And I'm suggesting this for another reason. So if you look at the word good, in Greek there are two very common words for good that we translate into English. In other words, we translate those two words into English as the word good. The first one is agathos. And what that means is moral goodness or correctness. And James is not using that word here. He's not talking about moral correctness or goodness. The other one is kalos. And what kalos implies, what it indicates, is something beautiful. And so in essence, what James is saying is your life a beautiful life? Is your life marked by characteristics and qualities that would put you in a category of having a life that is beautiful? And I don't mean that in the, hey, flowers are beautiful sense. I'm talking about hardcore life lived out where you're fleshing out your faith, you're fighting it out, you're making the right moves, you're serving the right people, namely the God that we serve in heaven. You're doing things according not to how you feel or how you think or what you're pondering on Tuesday afternoon while you sip a cup of coffee, but you're doing things according to the way that Jesus is calling you to do things. And that's what James is getting at. He's suggesting that wisdom is a lifestyle. It's far greater than an idea that any of us in this room could grasp. So to illustrate this point, I'd like to ask, we got any baseball fans in this room? Yeah, okay. So maybe you're like me and you're hoping for some O's magic, as they call it, this October. Be pretty cool to see them do something, I think. We've all been waiting for a long time. At any rate, we're going to do a little baseball history lesson this morning to illustrate the point that James is making about the indicators of true wisdom. So if I were to ask you to name the baseball player who broke the race barrier in Major League Baseball, what would you say? All right. So you're tracking with me. Jackie Robinson. All right. War number 42 annually. Major League Baseball recognizes Jackie Robinson. Guys wear number 42. I think he's a pretty cool guy. At any rate, he's the first African American to play professional baseball, namely Major League Baseball. He was born in Georgia in 1919. He lived in a neighborhood where he was the brunt of prejudice. He was right in the middle of a lot of racial conflict, and that was a part of his upbringing. But with those challenges, along with the conflict that he experienced, what that built in Jackie Robinson was a blend of strength. It was also coupled with self-control. So this guy, Jackie Robinson, was an awesome athlete. He ended up going to UCLA for a time period. He ended up leaving early. But while he was there, he was the first athlete to ever earn varsity letters in four sports. So this guy had it going on when it came to hitting the field or hitting the sports arena. And though he became or eventually became a professional baseball player, he probably had the option to get into any other professional sport that he would have wanted to, because he was that kind of athlete. But he chose baseball. And the reason that I believe he chose baseball is at that time, professional baseball, Major League Baseball, was the preeminent sport in the United States of America. It was also segregated, meaning that as a black man, there's no way he had a shot at playing ball. But he ends up getting this opportunity. And ordinarily, so you have this guy, Jackie Robinson, who he's a very fiery individual. He holds some pretty deep convictions, and generally speaking, he is willing to put them on the table and go to bat for those convictions that he holds. However, what happened was the fearless expression that he normally carried around with him was silenced when he signed a contract with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And the reason why it was silenced is because Jackie Robinson embarked on a mission to prove something to Major League Baseball and to the world. And namely, what he was trying to prove is that African Americans had the mental and athletic toughness to compete at the highest levels. That's a big weight to carry on your shoulders. He decided to take that on. And what that meant is that he had to exhibit a toughness, an ongoing toughness, that was tempered by this level of tenderness. So he couldn't just fly off the handle and defend his cause just because he felt like he was right. He had to lay something down. He had to lay down his rights to walk this thing out. And so based on the circumstances, this guy was not met with warm and open arms by fans or fellow ball players. And so he really went through the ringer for a couple of years where he was the brunt of everything that people could lance at him. And there was one particular occasion where he's out on the diamond and the Brooklyn Dodgers are playing against a team from Philadelphia called the Phillies. And Jackie Robinson has a bullseye on him. I mean, he literally is taking everything that they've got. They've come up with the most cruel epithets that they could possibly contrive, and inning after inning, they are blasting Jackie Robinson. This guy's blood is boiling on the inside, but he's got to maintain this level of self-control because he's got a lot riding on this. And so that particular day, Jackie Robinson was faced with a real challenge. His poise was on the balance scale. And something interesting happened that day. See, Jackie Robinson played second base next to a guy named Pee Wee Reese. Pee Wee Reese is a white guy from the South. He's not necessarily looking at Jackie Robinson thinking, yeah, I'm glad you're here. But something happened that day. And Pee Wee Reese, through all of that, had a decision to make. And so what he decided to do at a certain point in that game, Dodgers are tossing it around between innings. Pee Wee Reese walks from his post at shortstop over to second base and just puts his arm around Jackie Robinson, and he looks dead into the Phillies dugout and just smiles at him. And it was like at that point in time, he broke the Phillies. They just shut their mouths. That was the end of it for them. They realized for some reason that their words were not penetrating the heart of a man. And I think that's what James is getting at. He's getting at a wisdom that is steeped in humility and meekness, to the degree that when life smacks you in the face, you don't fly off the deep end. You don't fly off the rocker. You don't smack it back. You walk it out and you trust that God is doing something beyond anything that you've ever imagined. And so that's point number one, that wisdom is a lifestyle. And I believe that had Jackie Robinson flipped out that day, or any other day prior to that, Pee Wee Reese putting his arm around Jackie Robinson would have done nothing. But the reason why that was such a meaningful exchange was because Jackie Robinson had walked a real fine line, and he continued to walk a real fine line, where he was resting in the wisdom that he was getting from God and not in the wisdom that was stirring in him because of emotions. And so as we move on beyond the litmus test that James has given us for wisdom, namely meekness, or a lifestyle that we could call beautiful, or a lifestyle marked by beautiful conduct, he's gonna shift gears a little bit. And what James is going to get at next is that not all wisdom is wise. And so he's going to juxtapose real wisdom, authentic wisdom, this little snapshot of it that we just saw, with the idea that not all wisdom is wise. And so here's what James says: but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. I mean, if you're not sitting down, you might want to sit down for this one. James used the word demonic. I don't even know what to do with that, honestly. But what I'm saying is he's getting heavy with his people. He is calling a spade. He's doing what James does. He's pastoring the Jerusalem church by challenging them where they sit. And what he's really saying is, it's the way you live, not the way you talk, that counts. mean-spirited ambition isn't wisdom. Boasting that you're wise isn't wisdom. Twisting the truth to make yourselves sound wise isn't wisdom. It's the furthest thing from wisdom. It's cunning. It's conniving. It's downright criminal. Whenever you're trying to look better than others or get the better of others, things fall apart and people end up at each other's throats. James is calling his people to the carpet for their reliance upon a counterfeit, man-made wisdom that destroys people and relationships. He's getting serious. He's calling a spade, and he's doing this because these are the same people that heard him when he said, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. James is writing to people who love Jesus. Some of us here are people who love Jesus. So the question becomes, what does this text mean for us? I think James is directing us to the treacherous ground that we stand on when it comes to counterfeit wisdom. He's pointing us to our general lack of true wisdom and the ease at which we adopt an affinity and an assent to counterfeit wisdom. And in descending order, what James says is, counterfeit wisdom is earthly, it's unspiritual, it's demonic. So here's a real practical question for us. How do we identify counterfeit wisdom in our own lives? And James just point blank tells us. He says that where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. So he's being helpful as well. He's not just beating people up. He's not just giving people bad news. James is saying, hey, there's something that exists. It's really negative. It can really hurt you. Here's what it looks like. So be on guard. Be on the lookout. And I think that's a very practical thing for James to do. And so you see, if jealousy and selfish ambition lead to disorder and division, then what we're seeing is the result of a person who's living a self-serving life, a life that's really centered on the individual as opposed to on others. And James says, Paul says, Jesus says, the entire Bible says, the Proverbs say, that there's no true wisdom in a self-serving person. And this is what James is saying. A person who has not subdued himself, denied himself, given himself over to serving God and serving others does not possess true wisdom. I mean, that's heavy. That is heavy, folks. At least it is in my opinion. So from where I stand, I'd put some money on the line that some of us have gone through some real challenging seasons. Seasons that have left us with more questions than answers, more failures than victories, more weeping than laughter, more debt than riches. And I would even go so far as to consider the fact that probably some of us, that's where we are right now. We're right in the middle of a season like that, where things just are not working out. And when you look in the mirror, you're like, that is someone else's life. That's not the life I planned out. That's not what I mapped out. That's not the financial plan that I had. That's not the plan for relationships that I had. That's not the marriage I dreamed of. These aren't the kids that I thought I was going to have. Yeah. Sorry, kids. And so, what happens when we go down that pathway of thinking is we start looking around, and we're good at comparing things, at least we think we are. And we're looking at other people, and we're looking at other people's circumstance, we're looking at other people's marriages, we're looking at other people's prayer lives or Bible study time or social network. I mean, you name it, we're looking at the aspects of other people and we're saying, man, I hate that person. You know, it's like somebody walks up to you, you're going through it, and they're like, God really answered my prayer the other day. And you're like, okay, this is going to be weird. And then they go on this whole discourse about how they lost their car keys and how when their husband came home, he opened the door and he found the car keys in the other side of the door. And that's how God answered their prayer. And you're like, I don't even want to go to home group with you anymore. Because you don't understand problems. You don't get it, all right? But you know what? This is the jealousy and the envy that James is getting at in this text. We tend to respond with envy and jealousy when we face adversity or trials. And it's simply because of this. We continuously fail to relate our trials and our circumstances to God, to the wisdom of God. And what that really means in a practical sense is we have lost sight of reality. Because if God is in control of reality and we're over here panicking in the corner over some circumstance or trial that we're going through, we have lost touch. And you know what they call people who don't have a grasp on reality? They're crazy. There are rubber rooms for those kind of people, all right? I don't believe that anyone in this room wants to be in a rubber room. But if you lose touch with reality, that's where it could land you. And what I'm suggesting is you might not end up in a rubber room if you lose touch with the reality that I'm talking about. However, you will make some really, really, really unwise decisions. And so here's what James told us in chapter 1 of his letter about trials. He said, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let the steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." So we respond with jealousy and envy because we have extensive knowledge upon knowledge upon knowledge of God, but we lack the wisdom that allows us to comprehend what he's accomplishing through our trials or our challenging circumstances. We fail to realize that through our troubles, God is establishing his wisdom in us. And because we lack true wisdom, here's how the logic goes. I have to look out for my own interests. If I don't, who's going to? I mean, tell me you haven't thought that one. I'm not convinced. I must strive for what I deserve. If I don't, I'll never attain it. And so we move even further out of touch with reality when we start accomplishing things. We're successful. We have these little victories in our lives. Maybe we get a degree, or maybe we, you know, we do something that's noteworthy and it's published somewhere. Maybe our friends like something that we've posted on Facebook and we feel like that's an accomplishment. I don't know. At any rate, we begin to proudly hail ourselves as if we've done something. Right, we've forgotten that anything we have came down from a place that we've never been and was freely given to us. And so proudly hailing ourselves is, again, we've lost sight of reality. Here's another scenario. Maybe you look around and you see some of your classmates, people you went to school with, and you're like, "Oh, that's nice. He has a really good job, gainful employment. Things are on the up and up, owns a house, has a great wife," whatever it might be, in that root of envy bubbles up. You're thinking, "Well, I was better than him when we were in eighth grade." And then you begin longing for eighth grade all over again, as if that's the coolest thing to do. Maybe you look at your colleagues at work and you see people moving up the corporate ladder and you're like, "I am way better at that than that guy." And you're jealous. You're envious. You think you should be moving up the corporate ladder. You have a better skill set, better work ethic. Regardless of the case, regardless of the scenario that we could invent or hypothesize about, what you're saying is, "I deserve what others have, and I'm going to get it despite the cost." And this is counterfeit wisdom. This is the counterfeit wisdom that drives individualism. This is the counterfeit wisdom that drives and justifies things such as racism, hatred, prejudice, divorce, adultery, dishonesty, pornography, theft, and as James says, every single vile practice that exists. What James is describing is something that, at the end of the day, it's deadly, it's lethal, and it's to be avoided at all costs. Now, the good news is this, is that it's God, the God that we serve, that ultimately overcomes the threat of counterfeit wisdom in our lives, and he empowers us to live well and to live wisely. And so the third thing that I'd really like to dive into is that wisdom is a person. And maybe that doesn't make sense. Wisdom is a person. It sounds weird. It even sounds weird for me to say wisdom is a person, because generally I think we think of it as something else. And here's what James says. He says, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So he's already described earthly wisdom and the miserable fruit that it bears. And now he's describing supernatural wisdom or true wisdom and the quality of life that it produces. So one of the things that I really appreciate about a guy like James is that this guy loves results. He talks about results. He talks about things in terms of cause and effect. He's already showed us that about earthly wisdom, the cause. He shows us what it is and what it produces. And now he's showing us this picture of wisdom that comes from above. And he's saying, hey, this is what it is and this is what it produces. And he's talking about some pretty awesome results, in my opinion. So as he shifts gears, he's painting a more clear picture to something he mentioned in verse 13 of this text. And he's using language to summarize much of what he's already said to the Jerusalem church. He's echoing Paul, who describes the fruit of the Spirit as love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And these are the characteristics of authentic wisdom. And God, the God that made everything, the God that knows everything, he's the origin of wisdom. And this is what James is saying when he mentions that wisdom is from above. He's basically saying wisdom, all wisdom, every bit of it resides with God. And if you don't remember, God employed this wisdom to create the entire universe. In fact, the Bible says that he laid the foundations of the earth with this wisdom. He created all things. He created the interrelationships between all things, the beautiful interaction between things. He also created the human being and the interrelationship between the human being and the soul. I mean, God has done things that are just mind-blowing, in my opinion, with the wisdom that he possesses. And so therefore, I'd like to just say this. There is a wisdom behind the universe that makes it work. It's responsible for the design of the things that you see. It's responsible for the design that happens to be your particular body, even though you're not convinced when you look in the mirror. God did design it. Amen? All right. So the wisdom behind the universe, it's not a theory. It's not a theory. It's not something that can be grasped by reading the newspaper. It's a person. It's a person that you can know, a person that you can love, a person that you can follow. And it's not a person that you arrive at through contemplation, but it's a person who came down to us. He came down from above to us, and he fully relates with us as human beings. Wisdom is a person, and that person has a name, and his name is Jesus. And so James ultimately is describing Jesus when he says the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Jesus is wisdom, and he empowers his people to live lives rooted in his wisdom. And we see wisdom in every single aspect of his life, in the way that he interacts with people, in the way that he approaches the truth, in the way that he approaches every conversation that he ever had, every exchange that he ever had, everything that he ever did was wise. So as I wrap up today, I'd like to zero in on an Old Testament story. In 2 Kings, we find out about this little girl. If you've ever read 2 Kings, it's right around chapter 5. You hear of this little girl. She's nameless. The Bible doesn't tell us what her name is. And she's an Israelite whose parents were slaughtered at the hands of the Syrian army. All right, so she's an orphaned Israelite. And as a result of what the Syrians were doing, they were campaigning and just wreaking havoc. And in this particular case, they wreaked havoc on the Israelites. She became a part of Syrian culture in that she was taken into Syrian custody and became a servant in the home of her enemy. And that enemy had a name. His name was Naaman. Naaman was the commander of the Syrian army at that time. He's the one who led the raid that left this little girl's family absolutely dead, that made this little girl an orphan. And as the story goes, Naaman, he's wreaking havoc on the world. He's living a very self-centered life. He's doing what he thinks he's supposed to do to get where he thinks he's supposed to get. And he's leaving people maimed and injured. But also, Naaman has his own problem on his hands. He has leprosy. So he's literally dying. And so contrary to the response that this little girl could have had, she could have been downright mad at Naaman. She could have been plotting on how she's going to take him out while he's sleeping. She happens to live in his house. She could have been filled with rage because this master that she's serving now is the same guy who killed her family. She would have been perhaps justified in our minds in doing that, in executing a form of judgment on him by taking retaliation, but she didn't. Instead, using what she knew, she decided to dialogue with Naaman's mistress, and she put Naaman's mistress on to a person by the name of Elijah. And Elijah was a prophet in Israel at this particular time, and God moved through Elijah, did some pretty awesome things. If you have some time to take a peek at his life, I'd recommend doing that. But so soon after that, Naaman finds out about Elisha. He sets out to meet Elijah. This guy is he's proud. He's as proud as they come. So he makes his way towards Elijah, but he doesn't go to Elijah's house. He's figuring, like, I'm the guy. I'm proud. I'm making moves. I've got a pretty good resume. He goes straight to the palace, and he engages the king, and he's like, "King, it's time. I'm trying to be healed." And the king looks at him and he's like, "Man, you don't even know what you're talking about. I can't heal you, only God can do that." Naaman gets mad. He gets angry and he rides out of town. And eventually he makes his way to Elijah's house. And Elijah does something interesting. Elijah won't even meet him at the door. Elijah sends out a servant. This is another pet peeve of Naaman's. He thinks, "I'm VIP. Where I go, I get in." But Elijah's not looking at it like that. He sends a servant out to meet Naaman, and this makes this proud Syrian general even more angry than he was before, because he's figuring, "I should be able to have audience with whomever I choose." So here's where it gets interesting. The servant, Elijah's servant, points at a dirty river, and he's like, "Hey, Naaman, do your thing. Dunk yourself in there like 7 times, and you'll come out clean." All right? It's kind of be like, you know that little river? I don't even know what it's called. I drive by it on my way here. It smells horrible, okay? We drive by and we're like, my kids call it the stinky creek or whatever. Because it gets up in your nose, and for a couple thousand feet after the fact, you're like, "Man, what's going on in the back seat?" Anyways, so that's the filth that Naaman's looking at. It's on that kind of level. And Elijah's servant is like, "Hey, go take a bath in that." And Naaman's like, "No. I'm not bathing in there. I could have done that somewhere else. What are you, nuts?" So Naaman, he's fired up. He rolls out. And as he's making his way back to wherever he thinks he's going, his servants approach him and they challenge him. They basically say, "Naaman, you really need to take advantage of this opportunity. This is going to change your life." And so eventually, what Naaman does is he changes his mind. And he gets in the filthy river, he does exactly what he was told to do, and he's immediately cleansed of leprosy. The Bible refers to the skin that he has after getting out of that river as skin that's kind of like a baby's skin. Naaman is immediately transformed. And he does something beyond just becoming clean on the outside. Naaman starts worshiping God. He starts proclaiming that the God of Israel is the only God, the true God. So that's kind of awesome. You have this non-Israelite guy who gets saved in the Old Testament. But what's the point? What's the point of that? And the point is this: we're all just like Naaman. I mean, we're really a lot like Naaman. And so here's the scenario. This little girl, she knows the entire scoop on Naaman. She knows that the blood of her family is on Naaman's hands. She knows of his pride. She knows of his physical decay. And ultimately, she is aware of the fact that Naaman has a leprous heart. She knows that Naaman is out of touch with reality. The reality that he's dying and he cannot save himself. She knows that he needs something that only wisdom can provide. And likewise, Jesus, when he peeks at us, he knows that our lives are stained. He knows that we're proud. He knows all about the envy that's in our hearts. He knows about our jealous thoughts. He knows about the counterfeit wisdom that we tote around and make decisions with. He's full aware. And like the little girl, though, Jesus, he doesn't abandon us in our leprous state. No. He comes to us. He came down to us to clean us up, to wash us up the same way that he washed up Naaman, to make us new, completely new. And I'm not talking about I'm Mike, and I'm a new version of Mike, and it's not a new version of you or what you used to be. You are absolutely brand spanking new when Jesus gets a hold of you. So, I'd like to end on this. Wisdom is a person. His name is Jesus, and he is steady at work, making people wise, to lift people from the circumstances of lives that don't make sense, and to move them into lives that are rooted in the wisdom that came down from heaven to earth in the person and work of Jesus Christ, to empower people to live well and to live wisely. That's all I got for you this morning.